If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast is with the medical historian and journalist Mark Honigsbaum about his book, The Pandemic Century, which charts how the world has been shaped by outbreaks of infectious diseases over the past 100 years, starting with the Spanish flu. The book was originally released in 2019, but Mark has recently updated it with a new chapter and an epilogue addressing the coronavirus pandemic. Our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, called him to find out more.
Mark, one of my main takeaways from reading the updated edition of your book is that the world should have seen COVID-19 coming. I mean, would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yes, absolutely. So what I try to explain, well, first of all, what I try to lay out in the original hardback edition of The Pandemic Century that came out in 2019, that pandemics have always occurred in history, so it's erasing certainty that there would be new pandemics. But in particular, I tried to look at the last century of pandemic outbreaks, beginning with the Spanish influenza in 1918, and following those outbreaks all the way through to Ebola in 2014 and Zika in 2016. And what was clear even then was that these events were becoming more frequent the nearer we approached, you know, the present day. And in addition, there were plenty of people warning, you know, that we had to prepare. So what I did when after COVID struck was I went back and took a closer look at some of the groups such as, Bill Gates is one of them, but also John Hopkins Center for Health Security, who ran a pandemic simulation exercise in New York in October 2019, where they specifically modeled an outbreak on a coronavirus. The only difference was in their simulation, the outbreak starts on a farm in Brazil rather than in a city in China.
So why has COVID-19 apparently taken the world by surprise? I mean, can we put it down to complacency?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of factors, of which complacency, this theme of hubris, which I explore in the book. So there are lots of interlocking factors, but I think the main thing that this pandemic illustrates is one of the main themes that I try to get at in my book, and that is that scientific knowledge of infectious diseases, of course, has allowed us to control and in some cases eradicate infectious disease. So it's been a great boon to humankind. Thanks to science, we have vaccines and antibiotics and all sorts of interventions that we know will control and be effective against certain diseases. But as much as we know, there's always a lot that is hidden from us and from science itself. And sometimes those things that are hidden can be because we only have partial, we don't have fully understand all the aspects of a specific disease that we may have seen before. Or in this case, it can be that we just don't know about something because it's completely unknown. Before COVID struck the World Health Organization, who had kind of got their fingers burnt, they've been widely criticized when Ebola erupted in West Africa, that they didn't seem to think that Ebola could pose a threat to West Africa because all the previous Ebola epidemics have been in Central Africa in these remote forested regions. They then made a collective effort to try and think out of the box. And they came up with this new category, Disease X, which would designate a pathogen that was completely unknown to science, but was a theoretical possibility. And that's what COVID is, or to give it its proper scientific name, SARS-CoV-2. Of course, it shares some genes in common with SARS-1, the coronavirus that sparked the outbreak in 2002-03. But there are so many genes that are different that it really is a new category of corona, a new type of coronavirus, and therefore it was a complete unknown. And, you know, this is really why I think we were caught so unaware. There are other reasons, too, if you want me to go into them.
Well, before we get to that, I mean, you talk a lot in the final chapter of your book about the impact of our sort of increasingly interconnected world, climate change, budget airlines, and the soaring demand for animal protein. To what extent has globalization made us more vulnerable to infectious diseases like COVID-19?
Well, yes, I think it's made us many, many times more vulnerable. As you laid out, there are a series of interlocking factors which you could group under this concept of globalization. So one of those is simply the way that global trade and travel, particularly all the airline networks and the increasing connections, make the world a much smaller place from an epidemiological and also the point of view of immunology. So that means that a new virus emerging on the other side of the world in what in previous centuries would have been a remote habitat can very rapidly be anywhere in the world within 72 hours. So that's one thing. But I think the wider message of my book and why I think this coronavirus pandemic has been so important is it's really underlined the extent to which this is a problem now of planetary health. Because what's clear is that we know from veterinary ecology, from people who take a close look at the wild animal habitats where these viruses circulate continually, is that we're doing all sorts of things to make it more likely that they will spill over to human settlements. One of those things is that we increasingly encroach on those habitats for timber or for precious minerals, or indeed people in southern China and also across Asia and parts of Africa rely on these what are known in quotes as exotic sources of animal protein to sustain themselves. So it's quite common in China for people to go into caves in southern China, where we believe a reservoir a lot of these coronaviruses is. And sometimes it might be just farmers collecting feces from bats with which to fertilize their fields. Some people in China still eat bats as they do in parts of Africa, fruit bats. But also there's this other factor, which is because these are also the areas of the world where we're seeing very, very rapid industrialization and a transition from an agrarian society to a modern industrialized society. And what that means is you have people migrating from rural areas, towns and villages to these mega cities. And to sustain those populations, capitalism requires huge farming of huge amounts of animal protein. And we know that this industrial scale farming creates its own disease risk, because a lot of these emerging viruses, the classic one example being avian influenza. Avian influenza has typically transited to human populations via these domestic poultry flocks, pigs and chickens that are being raised on industrial scales to feed these huge urban workforces. So in recent decades, there's been a lot of sort of examination of these risks, and there've been plenty of warnings that we need to do better to control them. But I think the big wake-up call now is we have to really question, is this really a sustainable model? Not just for the planet, but for our own security.
Sure. You describe COVID-19 as China's Chernobyl moment. I mean, how do you rate the Chinese response in the last weeks of 2019 and the early weeks of 2020?
Well, I mean, I think that it wasn't great, put it that way. Their initial response was this knee-jerk response just to sort of deny that there was anything unusual going on, and then to seek to silence Chinese doctors, clinicians, who realized very rapidly that this was a SARS-like virus. So I think we did lose a critical period there, probably about 3 weeks in the beginning of January. On the plus side, though, the Chinese learned a lot from the mistakes they made during SARS-1 in 2002, where their reaction was to deny and obfuscate and cover up for much longer. And the main thing they learned was that it was important to share information. So what we saw at the same time was scientists at Wuhan Institute of Technology, but also in Beijing, rapidly sequenced the new coronavirus and published that entire sequence online, made it available to the WHO and made it available to other scientists all around the world so that they could see that this was a new virus. And I think it's at that point that we have to ask very hard questions of our own scientists in Britain and other countries who are modelling this virus and its epidemiology, and also the politicians who we really depend on to prepare for these, once in a century, or well, not even once in a century, they're happening more often than that, but to prepare for these risks, which we know can really present catastrophic crises for our societies.
So how would you rate their response? I mean, is it too early to do that? Or do you think, we can pass judgment now?
Well, I think one of the biggest ironies for me as a historian of pandemics, one of the pandemics that I've spent more time than any other studying as a historian and trying to understand is the 1918 to 1919 Spanish influenza pandemic. And what's clear is that the British government, but also the US, most governments' pandemic plans were modelled on an influenza pandemic. And in particular, 1918 as the worst case scenario of a truly catastrophic pandemic event. So the problem was that we were modelling our response to COVID based on a very different pathogen. So both influenza and COVID are respiratory diseases, but they don't spread in the same way. And the most important thing I don't think we fully realized was that, first of all, COVID has a much longer incubation time, 14 days. Influenza is a very short incubation period, 2 to 4 days. And also we now know that there were a high number of asymptomatic infections. What that meant was that a lot of the way that COVID was spreading was invisible to science. And also because of the assumption that it was kind of like influenza, Once we thought COVID was in Europe or in the United Kingdom, I think the reaction was, oh, well, it's here, there's nothing we can do, because based on the experience of influenza, once you actually know it's here, it's too late because it's got such a short incubation period. It's always already very widespread. That wasn't the case with COVID. We now know that better testing and, you know, tracing and tracking of those infectious contacts could have closed down or controlled the infection chains in a way that may have prevented us having to stop the whole economy for the sake of avoiding a surge on the NHS.
Mate, you're right that coronavirus research has been a victim of boom and bust funding, and scientists have been advised to steer clear of it in recent times. I just wonder if you could go into that a little bit, just explain why that's the case.
Well, yeah, so you only have to think about the most well-known coronavirus, which is the common cold. So if you go back to the early 70s, there was a lot of research on the common cold, particularly in this country, where a big effort was made to see if we could develop a vaccine against it. That went on for a while, but basically it was a failure. After that, we didn't actually discover a new coronavirus until SARS came along. Coronaviruses were considered, quotes, the Cinderellas of the virus world. Something that, you know, it might be interesting to look at late at night, but not something you should waste your waking hours on, particularly if you're a scientist trying to build a research career. And the main thing is that there wasn't funding for that research. That changed a little bit when SARS emerged, and we realized that, you know, there was this new type of coronavirus that did present an epidemic threat and possibly a pandemic threat. What happened was there was a brief surge in funding. But this pattern, we see this throughout the recent run of epidemics. It's what I call the cycle of panic and neglect. So there's always a big panic and a lot of interest when this new pathogen is identified. And we're all trying to understand, you know, what it is, how dangerous it is, and importantly, how to control it. But once the epidemic ends for whatever reasons, then that interest wanes, or we switch our attention to the next immediate pressing infectious disease threat. And that's when the neglect sets in and you see the funding, the funding available to researchers fall. So we really need to break that cycle. And there are organizations who've been trying to do that.
You also write that Spanish influenza, Spanish flu, made curiously little impact on the collective consciousness of society. Now, given that it killed so many people, why do you think that was the case?
Well, first of all, at the time, few people realised the degree to which it did kill a lot of people. And that's because we didn't have teams of disease modellers like Neil Ferguson in Imperial College or any of these other centres around the world, modelling this mystical number, the R naught, right? Newspapers weren't telling people every day, you know, which direction the R naught was moving. At the height of the second wave of the pandemic, if you subscribe to The Times or another newspaper, you could see that the names of the influenza dead in the obituary pages crowded out the names of the fallen of Flanders and other killing fields in northern France. But even after the pandemic was over, it wasn't realised the scale of the global mortality wasn't realised until many decades afterwards, when statisticians went back and recalculated these figures. But the other key reason was, there were two really. So you could be in Britain and your neighbour next door could be ill with influenza or have died a horrible death, and you may not have realised because there were not public, you weren't being bombarded by public health messages. And importantly, the newspapers were not amplifying those messages and reporting it very widely. So if you look through back editions of The Times or The Daily Mail, as I've done, you'll see that The Spanish flu is really relegated to the inside pages and, you know, right down the bottom of the pages. That only changes at the height of the second wave in October to December of 1918. But then it disappears. And then the other thing is that you have to realize that Britain and other countries like America, France, Germany were in the middle of a world war. And I think one of the lessons, historical lessons of pandemics is that war always trumps infectious disease. It's a more immediate existential threat. What's more, you can visualize the enemy quite clearly and you can direct, you know, all your propaganda and moral messages of fear and the need to take this seriously. Pathogens don't lend themselves to those metaphorical expressions in quite the same way.
But you'd argue that pandemics are just as inevitable as conflicts.
Well, I mean, as one of my favourite quotes is from Albert Camus from his book, 1947 book, The Plague, where he writes, "Everyone knows that pestilences have a way of recurring in the world. Yet somehow we find it hard to believe in ones that crash down on our heads from a blue sky. There have been as many plagues as wars in history, yet plagues and wars always take people by surprise." So, yes, I mean, I don't think there's any reason to believe there won't be more wars. And it's very likely there'll be more pandemics as well.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The message that I really would like to give listeners of the podcast is that we need to think in global terms, but we have to act locally, okay? Not just in medicine and science, but in our politics. I really think that local communities and empowering people with the scientific and medical expertise at a local level is the thing that is most likely to protect us in future.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
What can previous outbreaks such as the Spanish flu tell us about the likelihood of there being a second wave?
Well, I mean, this really comes down to, immunology, which is really the most difficult, I think, of all the life sciences to understand, particularly for, you know, your general listeners, people who haven't studied it, maybe. So so the key thing is that our models are always based on what we know about previous pandemics. And our best model for that are influenza pandemics. So typically the question is, at what point does the virus run out of new susceptibles, new people in the community who are still susceptible to infection and therefore can fall ill and transmit the virus to another susceptible individual? That depends on how many people have already had the illness and been immunized and therefore can be taken out of that model. And it's generally thought, based principally on influenza and diseases like measles, that you need to reach in excess of 60-70% herd immunity. With measles, it's higher, it's up to 95% really. But the working model for COVID is that until at least 2/3 of the population have been immunized, we're going to continue to see follow-on waves. Now, we don't know if they'll be exactly like influenza, because influenza seems to go away during the summer months. Not quite sure why, but it could be to do with that it's ultraviolet light degrades the virus quite rapidly. But probably it's more to do with the fact that people spend more time outside in summer, and therefore we're not crowded together indoors, which facilitate the transmission of respiratory viruses. The difference with the coronavirus is absolutely no one anywhere has any immunity, or didn't have any immunity before this epidemic started. That isn't true with influenza viruses. There's, even with a new pandemic virus, there's always a percentage of the population that have some immunity, because they will have previously been exposed to another pandemic virus that has continued to circulate up until this new one comes along. And frequently there are genes, proteins that your immune system will recognize that the new virus shares in common with the old virus.
And how hopeful are you at the prospect of us getting a vaccine?
Well, I really don't think we should be counting on a vaccine. I mean, I think, you know, we've heard lots of positive noises, but then when you actually read the small print of the studies, there seem to be all sorts of questions about the degree to which a particular vaccine candidate produces what they call neutralizing antibodies and can actually prevent the pathogen being, transmitted. I think it's possible, or, you know, maybe likely, we will get some kind of vaccine that maybe can reduce the severity of the disease. But I really think that the chance of a vaccine that actually prevents transmission is quite a distant prospect at the moment. That's only because we know it's very hard to induce immunity with coronaviruses, but also because most vaccines take, you know, at least 18 months, if not 5 to 10 years, to go from laboratory bench to doctor surgery.
Okay, now there's been a number of conspiracy theories swirling around the COVID-19 outbreak, but as you write in the book, this is nothing new. Can you give us some examples of conspiracy theories that arose off the back of previous pandemics?
Yeah, well, I mean, 1918, people thought that influenza was a biological warfare device that had been released on America by German U-boats patrolling the Atlantic coast. During the cholera outbreaks in the 19th century in Britain, but also in other countries, the poor thought that cholera was a ruse by the medical profession. The medical profession had deliberately poisoned their drinking water, simply because, in Britain, the rumour was that the medical profession had done this because they wanted to have bodies to experiment on, that anatomists were looking for cadavers. So the medical profession were accused of Birking after Birke and Hare, the two Scotsmen who murdered people, actually, and provided the bodies to the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh. So we always see variations on conspiracy theories in every pandemic. And I think that's really because pandemics bring home to us how uncertain scientific knowledge is and how contingent and chaotic life really is. So I think people hate uncertainty. You know, they want to know there's a rhyme or reason why things happen. Often we look to science for that. And when science can't provide the answers, we think they're part of the problem, part of the conspiracy. So I think that's really the appeal of conspiracy theories. They're kind of like they replace religion as kind of a way that populations can seek comfort in what they think of as their knowledge of the conspiracy.
And I guess we also like to find and identify scapegoats as well when things like this happen.
Yeah, so exactly. I mean, so pandemics, particularly where they seem to be associated with particular at-risk groups. So during cholera, it was the Irish who were accused of spreading cholera. During HIV/AIDS, it was labelled the gay plague. American news anchors used to go on primetime news and talk about the gay plague and talk about particular well-known homosexuals who had lots and lots of partners and were accused of being super spreaders. And we saw very similar language here from certain newspapers at the beginning of COVID. So the danger when you start to label certain individuals as, you know, being more likely to spread something than anyone else is that you then risk stigmatizing that group and singling them out for blame.
You also describe lesser known outbreaks, which I personally hadn't heard of, such as a great parrot fever and the something called the Philly killer. I just wonder whether you could just tell me a little bit more about those two outbreaks.
Yeah, so the great parrot fever pandemic of 1929 to 1930 is really one of those forgotten pandemics. I mean, the Spanish flu is often called forgotten, but this really is forgotten. There's been very little scholarship on it. But at the time, it was, a big event worldwide. It was picked up by all the tabloid newspapers. In particular, it was the William Hearst Group in the United States. William Hearst, who was the model for Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. So in 1929, Hearst newspapers picked up on the story about an Argentine theatrical troupe in Buenos Aires, where one of the actors had brought a pet parrot onto the stage. It was an operetta. They had like a sort of, a seafaring captain type with a parrot. And what happened was after this performance, the lead actor and his leading lady and several members of the cast fell ill with parrot fever and died. Very soon after that, cases cropped up in Baltimore and other cities on the East Coast. And then we started to see cases in Germany, in London. And pretty soon there were cases in something like 12 countries worldwide. And it was labelled parrot fever, but the pathogen could also be spread by pet parakeets and other birds that were typically given by husbands to their wives, or typically a fiancé would give it to his lover. And they were seen as tokens of affection, but also in an era before people had TV or even FM radio, a pet parakeet or parrot was seen as a way of keeping company for lonely widows or housewives during the day. What people didn't know or realize at the time was that these parakeets also harbored a bacteria, a form of chlamydia called Chlamydia sitticae, which produced this disease called psittacosis. And what happened is if you inhaled the dried, desiccated droppings, those particles could become lodged in the lungs and produce a very severe form of atypical pneumonia. And as with COVID, people died very, very rapidly. And the typical typical victims were elderly ladies, type of people who may have gathered around their pet parakeet for a cup of coffee and afterwards, didn't realize they were inhaling all these particles. So it really is quite interesting. I suppose one of the reasons I included it was also that, this was a pandemic because even though I think fewer than 1,000 people died worldwide, it was a new disease. It was in more than one country simultaneously. And people had no protection against it. So whenever we see, the basic definition of pandemic is simply a worldwide outbreak of a new disease. People think that pandemics have to cause massive disruption, as we're seeing now with COVID, in order to be pandemics. But that's not the actual definition.
Right, Mark, you also write in the book that in the future, historians may well refer to a pre-corona and a post-corona age. I mean, do you really think that what we're going through at the moment is that seismic?
Yeah, so I mean, this was actually this term before corona, BC, and AC after corona was coined. This term was coined by columnists in the New York Times quite early on. But yes, and I do think that this is a watershed moment in a way that perhaps other pandemics haven't been. And that's because we come back to what we said at the beginning, because the world is so globalized and interconnected now, and we have these long supply chains. So what's that meant? We can all see this, is that in order to control this outbreak, we've had to stop the economy, and not just our economy, but the global economy. And because of that, we're already seeing huge disruption to social life, but more importantly, we know there's going to be massive economic hit, in all likelihood, a depression that compares with the Great Depression of 1930. So for those reasons alone, I don't think there's any possibility that we'll forget this rapidly and be able to move on, because we're going to be dealing with the repercussions for some time. But more importantly, it's also a wake-up call that we can't ignore all the different factors we've been talking about that cause these events to occur and reoccur and will make them more likely to occur in the future. So, you know, if you think about what was going on before COVID, you know, the crisis we were all being told we faced was climate change. But because it seemed so remote from our daily lives, it was like we were paralyzed. We were unable to actually address it politically, even though the science was there and there was no doubt it was happening. And we could see it happening. I mean, COVID is something we haven't been able to ignore because it's here right now and we can see it poses an existential threat. So my hope is that there will be this window where we can use the fact that climate change is one of the factors that makes these pandemics more likely to also make us address the bigger threat of climate change, which, you know, really could spell, in theory, the extinction of our species.
And Mark, my final question is, do we have to accept that we're unable to predict when the next pandemic will be? Or will it ever, you think, be possible to see one come in and then prepare for it?
Well, look, I think to a certain extent, we can already see these things. So, you know, in the new edition of the Pandemic Century, I spend a lot of time talking to veterinary ecologists, people like Peter Daszak, who works for the EcoHealth Alliance, an NGO based in New York, who have specialised in going to China, but also other emerging disease hotspots across Southeast Asia, and trying to see what's going on in these wild animal reservoirs. So they go into caves where we know bats that harbour coronaviruses reside. And they've been taking blood from bats and examining fecal samples, actively looking for the next coronavirus. And in the last 5 years, they've identified something like 500 coronaviruses, 50 of which have SARS-like qualities, so could theoretically be triggers for another pandemic. So we already know what some of these future virus and pandemic potential look like. What we don't know, and I think something is very difficult, and to answer your question directly, I think that really trying to predict when or where the next one will emerge is a fool's game. Because there are so many different permutations, and we know that these spillover events are occurring all the time in China and Southeast Asia. But it only takes one of these events to find the right person in the right network, if you like, to spread it more widely. So what we really need to do is invest in better healthcare systems so that we can spot it quickly and we can close it down rapidly. And what that requires is much more investment all over the world in diagnostic tests, laboratories near to the areas where these things occur. So the message that I really would like to give listeners to the podcast is that we need to think in global terms, but we have to act locally, okay? not just in medicine and science, but in our politics. I really think that local communities and empowering people with the scientific and medical expertise at a local level is the thing that is most likely to protect us in future.
That was Mark Honigsbaum. His book, The Pandemic Century, A History of Global Contagion from Spanish Flu to COVID-19, is on sale now, published by W.H. Allen. If you are interested in this discussion, you can hear more conversations about Spanish flu and a historical perspective on coronavirus in our podcast archive. Just head to historyextra.com/podcast to search for those. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Wednesday when Keith Lowe will be talking about war monuments.